Blog Talk Radio.
August 26, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how's your summer coming along? I mean, it's summertime, and a lot of people aren't getting out as much. I talked to a friend the other day, and he was telling me that, you know, man, I don't have time to go anywhere. I don't have time to get out and do anything. It's, the summer's ending pretty soon. The fall equinox is September the 22nd. And I have to agree with him a little bit. You know, when we're kids, I mean, I remember my summers. I used to go to summer camp. I used to do swimming. I mean, it was idealistic, really. It was fun. I enjoyed myself quite a bit. And as soon as you have to start working, summer's different. Summer, they all blend in. Seasons all blend in. But there's something about summer that I think is very special. And perhaps it's just that I like getting out when it's warmer. I can hike. The days are longer. God, it's one of those things that you really got to take up and get into. Summer activities, you know, either it's camping, it's hiking, it's getting out in nature. But I totally understand where he was coming from. So it's 9 to 5. You know, you don't stop working just because it's summer. But hopefully, you take a vacation. Hopefully you get out and you take a vacation and you can go somewhere just for a day or two or something. It's important to get out and kind of break up the monotony of going 9 to 5 every day. So anyhow, I hope you're enjoying your summer. This is a good summer for me. My vacation is coming up in October. That's my big vacation. That's the trip to Maya land. Those of you who have been listening know that that's big on my list. Hey, and by the way, if you don't know about it, hey, this is Cliff. Hey, come join me October 28th through November 4th for a tour of ancient Mayan ruins in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. This is 7 days, October 28th through November 4th, of explorations. Every day, we'll visit a unique site, we'll check out museums in the area, even see a cenote, and we'll visit some of the most unusual cities that typically tourists don't go and look at, places that I've been to, that I've felt a tremendous amount of energetics from. And this is 7 days of intense exploration, and you can read all about it by going to earthancients.com/tours. Come out and join me. It's a once-in-a-lifetime visit to Yucatan, Mexico, and the land of the Maya. Yeah, that's a little promo for that. And if you're interested in the Maya, if you're interested in ancient cultures, you can see the entire itinerary. It is on earthancients.com/tours. And, you know, the real cool thing about this is that most of these tours are over $3,000, and that's a chunk of money. And that doesn't include your travel. I cut that in half. I mean, last year I was going to do a tour and it was like $3,200 a pop. I cut the price in half. It's $1,600. And you got to throw your flight in there. If you're coming from the U.S., it's fairly inexpensive. So the flights are maybe $300 or $400. The full 7-day tour from the 28th of October through November 4th. Our base will be in Mérida, and every day we'll do something. We'll go to a number of noted sites like Chichen Itza and Uxmal. But the smaller sites are the most interesting because they have a lot of standing architecture. They have a lot of standing statues and reliefs that a lot of people don't talk about. And I mean, I find going to the smaller unknown cities really the highlight of travel to Yucatan. So anyhow, your hotel's covered, most of your meals are covered, all the travel, the bus touring, and in the time that we spend on the actual grounds, these ancient ruined grounds. So check it out, earthancients.com/tours. Hope you can join me. It's going to be a good time. All right, so I have crossed the barrier. I have crossed the weight barrier. You guys know that doing this new diet, the intermittent fasting diet. Thanks to you guys that sent me emails and posts. Mateo sent me a really cool photograph. Mateo, I think he lost like 60 or 70 pounds on this, and it was amazing, the before and after photos. So, Mateo, thank you. Those of you who also sent me photographs, my goal is to lose 25 pounds by October 27th. I'm down. I've lost 10 in the last, it's almost been a month now. And for me, what I do is I'll eat regular three meals for one day, and then the next day I won't eat anything from the previous evening to the following evening. I won't have any food. And so it's a water fast. I drink, you know, it's coffee, tea, juice and stuff like that, but no food. And it's working. It's amazing. I'll take some photos while I'm down in Mexico. You can see the actual proof of what I've been doing. So it's not for everybody. And if you have metabolism issues, you got to talk to your doctor. Hey, but I'm following Dr. Jason Fung's FUNG's program, and he actually works with people with type 2 diabetes. And this program, this intermittent fasting, it's kind of cool because he helps people get off the diabetes medicines, the diabetic injections or pills or whatever they're taking. So it's a really very powerful way of not only healing, but for me, getting those pounds off. Got to get those pounds off. Not good. Okay, hey, this week we're doing a giveaway. I have a case of Eric Van Denken's new book, Astronaut Gods of the Maya. And here's what they say about it. Sharing more than 200 full-colored photographs of his personal archives, best-selling author Eric Van Denken provides clear evidence of ancient alien contact and technology among the archaeological sites of the Maya, as well as other ancient cultures such as the Aztec and the Hindus. He reveals how the gods, immortalized in Maya sculpture, carved reliefs, and myths, were not supernatural beings but technologically advanced visitors, astronauts who gifted the Maya with their sophisticated understanding of calendar, time, and cosmology. Van Denken explains how, with no explanation of other technologies and origins, the Maya interpreted the visitors as divine, and thus the gods were born. So I have 12 of these books that I'm going to give away. If you want a copy, the first 12 people that send me an email, send an email to cliff@earthancients.com and include your mailing address. If you don't send your mailing address, I'm gonna go to the next person, because a lot of people, when I do this, will just send in their name and go, yeah, hey, I want a book. And they don't send me their mailing address. I can't do anything when you do that. Anyhow, send me your address and tell me that, hey, Cliff, I'm interested in the new book, and post the name of the book, Astronaut Gods of the Maya by Eric Van Denken. Say, hey, I'd like a copy of that book. First 12 people who get it to me, within the next 12 days, I'll ship out a copy of the book to you. So there you have it. And I think this went up on Amazon a couple of weeks ago. It was late. I was talking to the publisher. The publisher is Inner Traditions, who I work with quite a bit. And this is it's kind of a cool book. It's over 200 photographs of his travels in Mexico, a lot of close-ups. And one of the things I found in this book is that he took photos of Copan, looks like about 20 years ago or longer, when they hadn't consolidated a lot of these standing markers known as stela or stela. And in a series of these photographs, he shows what appears to be carved gears. And I've used that photograph a couple of times, but I didn't know he had put it in this book. He uses it in another book, but there's a lot of very, very cool photos to check out. Astronaut Gods of the Maya. If you want a copy, cliff@earthancients.com. Tell me what you want and give me your street address. And you might be one of the first 12. I'm going to get them out. I'm going to clear them off my desk and you can get a copy. So check it out. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia, and they're doing and they're continuing their special. Remember, Gaia has over 8,000 titles, 8,000 shows, original documentations, original movies, a lot of really cool specials from a lot of people that are here on Earth Ancients. And the special is 99 cents for the first month. Now, to get the deal, you got to go to Gaia. That's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients for 99 cents. Pull out that dollar bill and send it to Gaia, and you will get access to thousands and thousands of titles. I mean, these titles are not, you know, somebody holding up a video camera and taking photographs. These are high-level productions. We talked to Melissa. We'll have her later on the show telling us what's coming up in the next few weeks. But this is a great opportunity and a really nice starting point for 99 cents to check out for a solid month. What is happening in the world of Earth Ancients, not only for us, but so many other subjects, Eastern philosophy. If you've never meditated before, they have a meditation section. They got yoga. You can learn a lot of material from Gaia. It's GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. Check it out. I think you're going to, if you haven't checked it out, just at least look at it, because there is so much material in there. I mean, it's like your own private video catalog of all things Earth Ancients, New Science, and if you're into Ancient Aliens, they have tons of stuff there.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some,
it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Hey, and if you haven't checked out the Facebook page, a lot of this material is transferred automatically onto the Earth Ancients website. Lots of very cool imagery this week. There's a really cool, actually it's a fantastic drone flyover of Silbury Hill. And that's the site of the largest man-made mound in Europe. It's estimated to be about over 5,000 years old. And the drone actually circles this mound in such a way you can see a lot of details that aren't typically available in regular photograph. So check it out. It's on the Facebook page. Along with that, there is a new crop circle that was found in Southend, Essex, England. And this crop circle is monstrous, but it's not only huge, there's a section built into it where there's a number of very strange symbols. And the flyover flies directly at an angle that you see all this detail. You see the scripts, the symbology, and they had the drone fly over before anyone could step into this crop circle. Now, if you haven't seen a crop circle before, most of you listening have, I posted a photograph about 2 months ago of these little white balls that appear when they're, these crop circles are made. A lot of them are hoaxed. Now, we know that. A lot of them are fake. But a lot of them are actually made in, from some form of technology, earth-based technology. We don't know. I mean, it's, they're really weird how they're made. This is a very cool one. And it seems like they're getting more sophisticated. So check it out on the Facebook page. Our own Facebook member, Ernest Pfeiffer, has posted a number of galleries from his trip to St. Augustine, Colombia, which is in South America. And his photographs are excellent. He's a good photographer. And these are galleries of unusual sculptures, very ancient sculptures, standing sculptures, megaliths, stone megaliths that are set on top of other stone megaliths. This is a culture that he's highlighting that we don't really know much about, but he details it beautifully. Ernest, thanks for those. Those are three galleries that you can see, probably over 100 photographs of Colombia, South America, a civilization that we only can kind of guess at. And very, very clearly shown in these galleries. So hey, check that out. Always be looking at the galleries every week because we post probably a minimum of two or three now. The more people are on tour or vacationing in various places, they will send me photographs to post. And hey, I love that because we can't all travel. Some people are able to travel more than others. New discovery in Palenque, the site of an ancient Mayan city. The wife of Pakal, the famous king, Pakal was buried in this monstrous stone coffin. And on the top of that coffin is a huge 1.2-ton top, stone top that has beautiful carvings in it. A lot of people think it's Pakal flying in a spaceship. I don't know about that, but his wife, known as the Red Queen, has been discovered. And she was covered in cinnabar, which was used as a preservative. And she's in another building, but apparently they've deciphered the writing, and this is his wife. They call her the Red Queen because the cinnabar is rich, dark red, and it covers her entire skeleton, which they believe was covering her physical body, the skin, the musculature, everything else. So as the time turned, what was left is her skeletal remains with a number of jewelry pieces and headwear and what's left of other pottery and things like that, and tons of the cinnabar. So you can see the whole thing on the Facebook page. Our friend Richard Casero has written a new article on the similarities between the Indonesian culture, the Khmers, their pyramid complexes, and those of the Maya in Central America. Now, I've talked about this in the past, and this is very prevalent. In fact, well-known Mayanist Michael Cole has pointed this out, not to the detail that Richard has in this article. And he basically just shows that there was a master blueprint for building pyramid complexes, how the stones were cut, very, very, very similar. Obviously, the stylistics are different. Indonesian pyramids are a little smaller, but they look very similar to the pyramids we see in Central America. And Richard points it out with startling detail in this article. You can read it on the Facebook page. And if you can't find it, on my website, I think it's there. If you can't, go to ancientorigins.com and look up Cassero, C-A-S-S-E-R-O, and you can see his article. He's a great writer. And when he writes something that he's discovered, it's very thoroughly investigated. So check that out. By the way, my article on Augustus Le Pleyong is delayed till next week. That article is called The Rogue Archaeologist, Atlantis, and Chukmu. And I have posted a number of photographs that I found of the excavation of the Chukmu at Chichen Itza, and also a piece that I have in my collection, a smaller version of the Chukmu, who I believe is not a warrior. I think he was a teacher, which usually translates to a priest in modern-day Maya, because the ancients, the earliest generations, were a different type of people than what we have today in the Maya culture. So check that out. I'll post more information on it on Facebook. I'll have it on my website. And always go to, if you're interested in more articles, go to ancientorigins.net, and you can see a lot of the details they have there. So now we're going to check in with Melissa Tittle from Gaia, find out what's happening this week in the new releases, everything from documentaries to first-run movies, just tons of stuff on Gaia, man. You gotta check it out. Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. The 99 Center, babe. The 99 Center. Do it. It's really amazing. Okay, so here's Melissa Tittle. So we're back connecting with our Gaia Director of Content, Melissa Tittle. Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm good. So we wanted to check in with you on some new releases, just mm-hmm. get an idea what's going on. And this week we talk a little bit about some of the shows that have been listed on the Gaia website, but actually launching. And the first one is the Hollywood Decoded. We talked about that last week. It launched, I think it launched on the 21st. And the first issue, the first episode is Matrix Trilogy. That sounds very, very cool, and that's a very complex movie with Jay Dreyer and Jay Widner.
Yeah, Jay Dyer and Jay Widner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what can you tell us about that? Because, I mean, I love the trilogy. The Matrix trilogy was very, very intense. And so what do we know about that?
The movie, well, this, you know, these two guys together break down, I mean, especially the first Matrix movie is my favorite. But I think what they're really trying to do, besides break down the movie as a symbolism for maybe your own reality and understanding it, is really kind of, how do I say this? The Matrix is sort of a Gnostic film, meaning it takes the principles from the Gnostic scriptures and it breaks it down into obviously a very entertaining movie. But the whole point of the Gnostic scriptures is to show you that your reality is based on a false understanding of your own universe, and that was embedded in you so that you would keep living your life in some kind of torture, you know, some kind of loop. Like, you know, like if you go to a therapist and you're always like, well, I have these patterns, and they're like, okay, well, let's try to break the pattern. And on a large scale, the Matrix represents that cyclical implant that we all have. And I find it to be a very representation of the Gnostic scriptures. But they kind of dive into that a little bit into the show.
Okay, so when you say Gnostic scriptures, is that from the writing team, writing director team? Is that one of their terms, or is that something that Jay came up with? Or is that something that you kind of decoded?
Well, I bet you if you interviewed the writers, I don't think that they would disagree. I don't think when that movie came out, people were reading into Gnosticism as much as they are now.
Yeah.
You have to understand that writers spend a lot of time by themselves, and they read a lot, right? And they pick up lots of things that they incorporate, whether they really, really think about it or not, into their movies. And what Jay and Jay are trying to do is really dissect that thought process. Sometimes when you're writing, you have absorbed so much information that you don't even know where it came from, even though it seems like it's deliberate. And, you know, Jay and Jay just dive into that a little bit more. But the then they definitely dive into Gnosticism, but having watched that movie, you know, way back in the day and knowing about the Nag Hammadi, I felt like it had the similar kind of values.
Right. Very cool. So that's that launched Monday the 21st, and I guess it'll continue for as a weekly series. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Cool. Very, very, very cool. So you can see that. Go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And if you're not signed up, the 99-cent deal is amazing. It's easy to do. And, geez, it's cheap. That is so cheap. All right. Hey,
yeah.
Melissa, continued wellness and happiness, and we will see you next week.
Sounds good. Have a great weekend.
So that's Melissa. And remember, 99 cents for the first month. If you guys have not signed up yet, you really need to, because they're going to be introducing a whole new series. Remember The Mummy? Well, there's new information on The Mummy. So Gaia.com/Earth Ancients, 99 cents. Man, pull the buck out. I mean, take out the loose change. Send it through the internet. Sign up. First month, 99 cents. Check it out. Okay. I hope you can at least consider it. There are some free things on there. If you're really tight for money, there are some free things on there. You can go to that Gaia.com/Earth Ancients and see that. But there's too much not to check out. So hope you can consider it. Today's interview is with a new author. Her name is Jan Hizar Hansford, and she's written quite an interesting new book called Anthrogenesis, and it is quite an interesting piece. It is what you can consider an encyclopedia of ancient history, sacred science, sacred traditions. And I really enjoyed the book, and this interview shows that it's quite a piece of work. And so here's the interview. I think you're going to like it. So over 30-plus years, many decades, I've collected all kinds of interesting books, Eastern philosophy, Blavatsky, Edgar Cayce. There's a whole history out there in what you can consider esoteric knowledge. And it kind of fits in many ways the whole ancient earth, earth ancients theme to have content like that discussed every so often, because what are we all about? Understanding the ancient past. And within the ancient past are the known and the unknown civilizations. And my guest today has kind of helped in a way in her new book bring all these topics together in what I would consider a wonderful encyclopedia. My guest today is Jan Hazar Hansford, and she has written a book called Anthrogenesis, The Study of Humanity, Ancient Beginnings, Origin, Spirituality, and Mythology. Is fabulous. It's fabulous because she has dissected our ancient past, the mythology that is supporting that, and the spirituality that goes along with it. Jan, wonderful to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Cliff.
Hey, I'm glad you could join us. Hey, you're out in Arizona. How is Arizona? How do you like it out there?
Oh, it's beautiful here. We have lovely weather, lots of great energy, beautiful people. What more could a person ask for?
I love it. Yeah, I visit Arizona quite a bit. I have friends out there. Of course, the native population is in that area too. Have you had a chance to see some of those wonderful petroglyphs that are in your neighborhood?
I sure have, actually. I was down in the Sedona area about 18 months ago, and I was surveying the petroglyphs down there on the Bar Ranch, I believe it's called. Wow, those are incredible. They have a lot to say about our ancient past and what our ancestors were thinking about when they drew those beautiful pictures on the rocks.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was amazed that somebody had uncovered an actual petroglyph of an eclipse, very, very old eclipse that was reproduced in stone, which shows that our ancestors sky watchers, which is kind of fun.
I believe that we've been sky watchers for, you know, millions of years. And it's just now that we're starting to maybe have a little bit of that memory coming back to us. It's slowly coming forward and still has a long way to go. But we have some of these memories just beginning to come forward in our senses, beginning to think about these things that used to happen to us a long time ago. And the ancient ways that we recorded them, whether it was on rocks or other ways that we recorded these events. A lot of times it was looking from the heavens. We were watching the stars and the constellations and trying to make sense out of those. And in fact, there's many, many that believe, and some of my colleagues also believe, that perhaps we even had more knowledge then than maybe we have had most recently or even to date.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. I want to ask you before we delve into the book, I want your opinion. I have worked with Native Maya and also Native North American tribes, elders. And it appears that the previous civilizations, and when I say previous, in my mind, I create a line. And before there was a catastrophic event, there was a civilization that lived on the earth that perceived reality in a different way. And what I've been told and what I'm coming to understand is that these people not only were highly intuitive, but they were able to cross into other dimensions, other realities, not necessarily full body, but in a level of consciousness that we don't understand today. Following this deluge or this catastrophic event, and what we're coming to know now was the Younger Dryas period, this cataclysm where those asteroids hit and then caused all this earth change. After that happened, and basically much of humanity was destroyed, we had to reboot. And we redeveloped, we re-embodied ourselves in a new conscious level. So my question to you is, what do you believe about that? Because a lot of your work in this book covers these earlier civilizations and how they perceive things. So I'm curious about what you think.
Well, I think that we have had a series of cataclysms, you know, that go back in time. I think the one that's most recent to us, that I think our ancestors, which is grounded in the native cultures and the native spiritual practices, is Atlantis. And as far as we know, in terms of actual documentation, the last component of Atlantis that disappeared was about 11,000 years ago, or somewhere near about that. But there were actually seven different progressions of the end of Atlantis, which takes us back multiple millions of years. And during that time of Atlantis was a golden age, a time when we were at the height of, I think, what human spirituality, human potential can be. We were connected to our planet. We were connected to our being. We were connected to all the kingdoms of the earth, you know, the animal kingdom, the mineral kingdom. And we loved each other. We were compassionate. We served. We did great things in this time. But somehow, I think we lost sight of that goodness, and we began to perhaps get selfish or begin to not think about Mother Earth or the things that we need to care about, the ground under our feet, the food in our mouths, and how to really be sacred about these things and how to really practice these sacred rituals. And so we lost that. And, you know, Blavatsky talks a lot about it being a break, an actual split. The rainbow bridge was broken. And this was approximately, from her timing, about 4 million years ago, which goes back to right when the first parts of Atlantis began to break apart. And at that time, we were escaping to different parts of the world. We were escaping to Europe and Asia. There's a place in Europe where actually the Gobi Desert is now. It's called the Gobi Sea, where a lot of us began to migrate. And even then, kind of go back even one step back, there was a preparation that was existing at Atlantis during these times, as far as the ancient teachings tell us. Mm-hmm. And there was things that were happening in Lemuria that kind of moved into Atlantis, because we were just beginning to become spiritual beings in Lemuria, which was probably 100 million years ago or something like that. At least that's the estimate. We were beginning to be spiritual beings and walking upright. We had supposedly large bodies. That's where the stories of the giants and some of those things begin to come into play into our mythology. We know about giants and we know about those things, but we don't really have any truth about that. Anyway, so in Lemuria, people were getting this spiritual walk, and they began to develop the body and the consciousness and even the third eye that we know about today, which center of the forehead, which is typifying the confluence of the soul and the mind together. That was all happening in Lemuria. Lemuria was a wonderful time to develop the body and the mind and the consciousness, moving into Atlantis, which again was millions of years, and we were learning about the earth. We were learning about our heritage here and practicing, you know, beautiful celestial, traditions and sacred ceremonies. We did that for millions of years, I think, and it was incredible practices. But then with the end of this rainbow bridge, when things were broken in the consciousness, then we lost God, so to speak. We lost that connection. We lost Mother Earth. We went into like an amnesia. We lost everything, and we forgot who we were. And that kind of took us up to maybe about 100,000 years ago or so.
Wow.
Is what the traditions say, you know?
Interesting. Now, you have a doctorate in clinical psychology, and... I mean, there is some flexibility within your profession, other than if you were an archaeologist or anthropology. But a lot of the material in your book is very radical, especially from an archaeological point of view, because we're talking tens of millions of years ago, and we're going to get into this book and some of the things that are in there. But do you feel any stress in producing the content in your book? Because a lot of the theories are hard to document. They're what you might call some of it's channeled material coming from a higher source into an individual and then getting it down on paper. We all know Edgar Cayce was the sleeping prophet, and he has volumes and volumes of knowledge, and a lot of that's in this content is in the book. What do you, I mean, how do you go about explaining that from an academic point of view? Or is it even one of those situations where you could say, look, academics, I am trained, but it doesn't, I don't flow academically.
Well, no. That's a good one. I'd like to use that somewhere else because I've had some discussions with people and they go, you're supposed to be a PhD, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, where did you get this information?
Yeah, like,
and
hey, doc,
you're right.
What's the story here?
Exactly. You know, my moniker is Dr. Jan. I mean, that's what a moniker that was given to me years ago when I started working a lot with kids, and they just, that was the easiest thing to say is, oh, Dr. Jan, you know? So, I mean, that's what I was called. And so, yes, I'm a, my goodness, you know, I'm a student of the sciences. And what can I say? I was raised up in science, in the scientific method. I mean, I did a lot of research, and in fact, I was a dissertation graduate chair, and I help people with their PhDs. So, I mean, I understand science. I understand the need to have a sense of proof. But there's a point where you get with this material where it becomes science. There's a marriage almost. You can almost call it a marriage between science and spirituality. It's that balancing of the pair of opposites, yin and yang, science and spirituality, men, women, just the two opposites. And, you know, many years ago, I started meditating, and that was something that I did to do stress reduction. It started out as that. And then as I kind of advanced over the years, I began studying meditation and then practicing meditation and doing all kinds of things that were enlightening. And I would say that this book is really a combination of science and spirituality, because one of the things that I wanted to do with the book was bring my science into it, but also bring the intuitive side of humanity, the spiritual side of humanity, the part that you can't say, oh, you know, there's thus and such, you know, journal article or this study, so to speak, that, you know, documents this and that. And honestly, I had a talk, it was supposed to be able to talk at different conferences and things. And when they found out that I was going to talk about Lemuria, they're like, how could you talk about Lemuria? You know, because Lemuria, like I said earlier, millions of years old, and how could there be documentation? And if there was even any land left, because Lemuria was dissolved basically by fire. So, I mean, I don't know. There was nothing left to speak of Lemuria. So needless to say, I had to find a way to bring the two together. And I think that I'm just kind of piggybacking off of, you know, the people before me, the scientists and the yogis and the people that have taught people and have meditated and how do we do it? We teach. We hopefully learn a lot about ourselves, and then we hope to teach others about our experience. And that's how you find this marriage, I think, of the two, you know, science and spirituality. It's a practice. It's a walk. Mm-hmm. It's something that's probably taken, you know, I think that there's probably reincarnation just because it makes sense to me. So, you know, a person has to have probably hundreds and hundreds of lives to get to a point where you can actually talk about these things and have some sense of making yourself understood, if you know what I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the book. This book is wonderful. I like it because you give highlights of so many different subjects. You get into sacred science, lost knowledge, historic notions, specific references. But again, so much of it, and I really did enjoy what I read. There's so much in there. Those of you listening, it's a truly a cyclopedia of the ancient past, pushed through in a very readable version for you in today's life. So, was the motivation to write this tome, Jan? Because, my God, it's over 600 pages. You have a tremendous amount of documentation, references, and it's just there's a lot to cover. So, what was the motivation?
Well, it is a compendium, and in fact, one of my editors said, "Why don't you put that on the cover?" maybe down the road, I will put that on the cover. What the motivation was, multifaceted, really. I started out, it was probably maybe 15 or maybe 15 to 20 years ago, and I got to a point where I thought, you know, there's so many different connections of things that I see in my mind's eye that I want to be able to put down in words, so that when someone is on the path for spirituality and they want to ask questions, they can have a book that they can open up and go, oh, wow, geez, there we've got the yugas, or gosh, there's actually science. He can actually, you know, learn about the Jurassic period and what was going on. Or, for example, what's the connection in mythology? So towards the back of my book, I discuss different myths and things across the world that captured this walk and this marriage of spirit and science. So for me, it was a way to pull that together. So I really think about it being an encyclopedia. And that's the only way a person can really read the book. You can literally open the book to a page and just go, oh, like, for example, I'm looking at the life of Confucius right now. Confucius was an influential Chinese for blah, blah. So, I mean, you can give that, or you can, you know, I mean, there's just lots of different parts of this book. I kind of touched on different, you know, philosophy, spirituality, scientific origins, spiritual origins, you know, and that's how it came about. It was me sitting in front of the History Channel and going, oh, my God, that makes sense. Yeah. And wow, geez, that's like when I was in China and I was blah, 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 blah. I don't know. You know, it definitely was a creative work. And I told my one editor, I said, you know, I channeled this book. I had to. There's no other way I could have done it. Yeah. You know, I sit down for like when I was really writing over the last few years. I would sit down for 10 to 12 hours a day in a lotus position and meditate and then just start writing. And that's how it went.
Wow.
I kid you not.
The subtitle is The Study of Humanity's Ancient Beginnings, Origins, Spirituality, and Mythology. I think, and I firmly believe that you have in many ways resurrected the ancient past, ancient knowledge, and you give bits and pieces of each of these multiple fields from our ancient past. But I want to ask you this. This is knowledge from our past, and it doesn't really in many ways fit our current paradigm where – and you actually outline the current three-age dating system that we have of the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. Why does that not work in the study of ancient history?
Well, it doesn't work because there's big gaps in our, I'll call it our memory, our human memory. We have memory loss. And so when we go back, let's say, to the last golden age that we had was the end of Atlantis, which was about, you know, 2 million years ago. That was the end of Atlantis, really, per se. And 2 million years ago, if we look at standard science and we look at what, for example, anthropology or any of those sciences of ancient humanity look at, they're saying that we were, you know, Cro-Magnon or even older. We were these ancient, unevolved creatures that didn't know anything. Well, as it turns out, when we think about what was happening in the Golden Age, we were actually very enlightened beings with perhaps multiple senses, maybe even hundreds of sensory apparatus going on within our mind, being able to do all these things and meditate and be compassionate and love and see the stars all at once. And somehow that doesn't resonate with a Cro-Magnon, you know, human hominin, which is supposedly doing nothing but just scrapping around looking for food and having a baby and roaming around, and it just doesn't work. So the two ideas are just incompatible. So current sciences, our current science is just unequipped. And it's almost like they're trying to protect this amnesia that we've had. I don't know what it is. You see it on the History Channel with certain things, or you see it in other media on television, how they just don't want to think, for example, that the pyramids are probably hundreds of thousands of years old. There's no way that we could have built those pyramids in the consciousness that we have now. In fact, we don't even know how to lift one of the rocks that comprise the pyramid. We can't even pick one up without humongous things that maybe might pick up a stone of a couple of tons, but maybe 100-ton stone, forget it. We don't know how to do that. So we have to go back, and that's where meditation and spiritual practices come in. Almost like you're going to trust that other part of you that kind of you hear about. Sometimes you hear that part of you telling you good things about yourself, and it's the good stuff that that part tells you. It's usually not the bad stuff. That part of your intuition that knows better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You actually bring up something that I touched on in the very beginning of our conversation, and that is that humans were probably a different makeup than who we are now. They probably, not that they're physiologically different, maybe they were, but there's just something about the people that built the pyramids, that the people that were into the pyramid complexes throughout the world. It's just something about those people that is different than we are today. Can you put your finger on that, other than maybe they meditated more, or that their whole lifestyle was more of a sacredness and a unification with the earth and the heavens?
Yeah, I think that humanity, part of this ancient tradition that we had, that we were in sync. We were in sync with the stars. We were in sync with the seasons. We were in sync with the equinox. We were in sync with the different seasons that passed through us, throughout the continents that we lived in. Mm-hmm. We listened to the earth. We built and we planted when we needed to. We didn't do more than we needed to. So we had this ability to gauge what was right. There was a rightness, there was an ethics, almost a morality, if you will, that we knew how to do things the right way. And we really didn't have to think much about it. We were in sync with the universe. Mm. We were in sync with the cosmos. And that's where the cosmological notion of Blavatsky and some of these ideas that she brought forth, seen in Hinduism and, you know, Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, that we bring those forward, but they were practices that went on within the ancient Egyptians and Sumeria and Greece, and even in some of the accounts that Plato talked about in Timaeus and Critias. I mean, there were things that were going on that we just knew what was happening. If you look at the pyramids, I mean, how can you build something so perfectly that a human hair can't even get in between the stones? There's no way that could happen unless you were just so in sync with your life and your world and the earth, Mother Earth, that there's no way you could do it. So you had to be in sync. You had to have this other part of you, this spiritual part, the soul body that was evolved. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it was, and I believe that that's what humanity did. We blossomed, and everything around us, we could touch life. I mean, almost. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that it was a beautiful world. I mean, there were flowers and rivers and water, and we didn't want for anything. And that's where that kind of the Garden of Eden sense comes in, when you hear about the biblical writings. It talks about this beautiful place that we could just exist. And I think that's what our ancient forebears did. I think that they were in sync, our ancestors. Mm-hmm. and whether they were in Peru or whether they're in Central America or whether they're in Egypt or Sumer or Greece or wherever they were in China, anywhere they were in sync with their life and their world. And everything just worked. It was harmonious. And they could look up into the sky and see the constellations were speaking to them. They could see the pictures that the stars made. They could watch how the stars changed day or each season. And they made their life a ritual. To, you know, that's where the sacredness of it came. They could look at the sky and go, wow, okay, this is what I do now. And then they built beautiful megaliths, pyramids, you know, beautiful boulders that were arranged. And then the question comes again, they had the power, whether it was, you know, telekinesis or whatever it was, to move those stones because they were in harmony with nature. It was a harmonious life.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mother Nature is very powerful.
Yeah. Amazing. I think one of the big issues for a lot of people, and a little bit of a distraction for Blavatsky and her writings, is that she claimed to have access to what now we might consider to be a cloud computing or a cloud database called the Akashic Records. And, you know, these are something that have been known about for decades, if not longer, maybe called by different names. But that's really it, is that these ancients had this ability to tap into this this cloud, as we can call it now, of unlimited knowledge of the past, the present, and the future. I think this is one of the reasons that the Maya could calculate into the billions of years in the past and into the billions of years or multi-millions of years in the future, was this access to this cloud. But I'm curious, and the big problem we have today is how do we get academics to begin to consider other forms of data, and except for, you know, just the three-dimensional artifacts that they see for themselves? Is it one of these things that they just have to die off? Academics, you know, 200-400 years in the future will have to just change because they're going to, you know, find it, or is our technology going to change or something? What do you say about that? Because that's the big challenge.
Well, look at Copernicus, or look at, look at any of the great people that came around, the great scientists that came around right at Kali Yuga ending and Dwapara Yuga beginning, which was about 1700, you know, current age, CE. So, I mean, all of a sudden you saw this change. You saw the planet changing. And all of a sudden you saw these great minds were blossoming. And it was almost like between the changes that were happening universally and, you know, what was happening with all these various levels of knowledge, then they were able to catch on. It was almost like they could put out a fishing rod, put out that line and grab onto a piece of knowledge. And we call it the Akashic Records. Or, you know, it's also called the Rainbow Bridge of Knowledge. I mean, different religions have different ways of talking about it. It's prophetic. It's something that you grab onto in an enlightened moment. You know, and you're in an enhanced state of awareness, and you get this image. You know, you get this feeling. One of the ways that I think we've captured that idea across time is the hero. And I've talked about the hero in my book, the hero idea, that there's this hero born that does all these great things, or heroine for that matter, excuse me, that's born, and this heroine or hero goes through life and doing all these great, great, things that could never happen with a human. They save lives. They save the planet. It's the superheroes and the superheroines of our world. They do these wonderful things, and all of a sudden they lose their life in the call of duty. And then all of a sudden they come back to life. They're reincarnated. The hero or the heroine comes back and saves the day. And these stories of the hero go through over and over again across time. I mean, you look at Joseph Campbell, who is an incredible savant, an incredible mind to be able to bring forward this idea of the hero. And then you look at the movies that are coming out today, and there's so many stories about the hero and what the hero does, and the hero saves this or saves that and saves the world. And, you know, I mean, this hero is one way I think that we grab on to this ability of our ancient forebears to grab onto mm-hmm. that prophetic moment. And it's also a way mm-hmm. of teaching, because I think our ancestors were heroes, and they had big bodies. They were giants. You know, you mm-hmm. look at Easter Island and you look at the Moai, and they had these huge bodies. We built what we saw. It wasn't something that we somehow, you know, dreamed up or whatever. We actually created these big bodies because that's what our bodies were. We had large mm-hmm. bodies. That's how we built the pyramids. That's how we yeah. lugged these big rocks around. Or if we didn't do that, we had telekinesis or other airships or air equipment could do these practices for us. I think that there was what people call magic, but really it was this esoteric ability to use power and channel it with love and compassion to help, mm-hmm. to help do things, to help create relics, to help create this yeah. sacred sense of being on the planet.
Yeah. There's so much that's covered in this book. We don't have the time to cover it all, obviously. It would take,
I know, huh?
Probably a month or two, or probably longer, just to cover the sections. But you touch upon an ancient dating system that I discovered maybe about 5 years ago. I had known about it, and those are the yugas, the Hindu yugas.
Yeah.
Conventional science cannot even grasp it. Anthropology, archaeologists, they have to see hard evidence in the form of carbon-14 dating or any of the other dating techniques that are available to them, especially when they're out in the field. But the yugas go back hundreds of thousands and millions of years in the past, and it really helps explain people like Michael Cremo's evidence of finding Homo sapien skeletons that are dated to 200,000-300,000 years. In fact, there's one or two examples of a 10-million-year-old Homo sapien, and where our anthropologists would say, no, we were ape people 10 million years ago. Why are the yugas so important in your work?
The yugas are important because I think what they do is they bring forward this ability to date and to somehow have a measurement, to have a tool mm-hmm. to say, okay, this is going to kind of correlate with that. So for example, Treta Yuga, which is 200 million years ago, or excuse me, 1,200,000 years ago, and Bronze Age or Dwapara, which is, actually we're beginning Dwapara. We're coming at the end of Kali right now, 864,000 years ago. But these are out of the Vedas. They're an ancient tradition that the Hindu sect developed so many years ago, so many hundreds and thousands of years ago. Probably, I'd say maybe 4,000 years ago. The Vedas are probably about 4,000 years old. But it was that way. It was that ability to date in some way to help give a mainstay to humanity, say, this is what we were. One thing that I know that I did in my book was I looked at Denisova, which is a hominin that's probably about 8 million years old. And I was able to kind of study, Denisova, how it began in, the first findings were in Siberia. And I was able to trace Denisova all the way over to Melanesia. And there was actually parts of the DNA that we find that are from Denisova that are actually in Melanesia, and they're nowhere else. But then later studies have shown that they're also in Neanderthal and some other of our ancient, ancestors. So in that way, we're able to take these yugas and go, okay, 7 million years ago. Wow, 7 million years ago. That was actually when Atlantis was going on. So I'm kind of, maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I want to just point that out, that mm-hmm. that's probably went around the time of Atlantis when we were looking at Denisova And Denisova was kind of a creature. Our hominin had big teeth. It looked ape-like. I mean, and we know from the ancient teachings and the writings that we did have these ape-like bodies. That's what we inherited from this planet. You know, there were supposedly ape-like bodies on this planet before we ever got here, which is what Blavatsky talks about. Again,
right. These
are things that, you know, I've studied for a long time, and, you know, I can say that now, but then I have to counter my colleague that says, well, how do you know that? So then I have to go back to the Vedas and say, okay, well, the Vedas say it was probably in Atlantis before the Golden Age, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you kind of move around like that, and that's what I did with the book, as I was trying to help people place their attention to, okay, we had a Jurassic. There was a time perhaps in our Jurassic past when there was an ancient human that actually might have even had a dinosaur as a companion, although it's not clear. Some of that stuff is from Rudolf Steiner, some of the work I did with him and reading a lot of his work. And again, some of the channeling that I might have done with this research, but honestly, some of it just makes sense. And you look back and you think, okay, what was going on there? There were dinosaurs, and they were flying dinosaurs, you know? It makes sense to me because I've studied it in these kind of ideas, you know?
And you're looking at it from a trained academic point of view, which is really refreshing. See, the thing that happens a lot of times is, and I see it here on Earth Ancients all the time, is here's an example. You're talking about humans living with diamonds. Well, if you look to South America, there is a number of researchers that have found in tombs and grave sites sculptures, figurines with people riding dinosaurs, standing next to them. Looks like they've made dinosaurs their pets. And immediately these are written off as hoaxes somebody falsified. Somebody was playing games. Well, when they date some of these tombs that these relics have been found, they're, you know, many, many, many thousands of years old, 4,000 to 6,000 years old. Why would they, you know, make up these figurines?
They wouldn't make them up. And then you've got to think about carbon dating. You know, carbon dating is a limited procedure. It only dates carbon. So we're limited. We can't date a rock. We can only date things that have carbon, the carbon, you know, components in it. So we're left to, you know, we see these digs, or we see, you know, the people that are there, you know, carving these beautiful dragon-like, that they look like a dragon, but they could easily be a dinosaur. And we think, what is that? Oh, that must have been some dream they had, or they had some dream of a dragon in the sky coming down to save them. And actually, it might have just been a dinosaur. You know, I mean, the thing about science, this is where science comes in. You want to find the simplest answer to things. You know, what's the simplest way to answer a problem in science is keep it simple. Okay, simple is always, you don't go out and extrapolating out into all these other ideas, and that's where science comes into this. So when you find a dig of dinosaurs, you're going to say, hey, this looks like dinosaurs. It's not going to, oh, this looks like some other, you know, supernatural creature that might have lived in the sky or whatever. It needs to be reality. And that's what people kind of forget when they look at these digs. This is reality. This is what people were seeing with their eyes. This is what they saw. They saw these creatures, you know, or like at Göbekli Tepe, you have all those, you know, creatures that are carved out of these rocks, these monolithic rocks. And that's what these people were living with, these animal creatures. And they also had tall, big bodies. They were not small at Göbekli Tepe, you know?
Yeah.
They were big. They were, you know, 20 feet tall probably. So it's probably, again, coming after Atlantis, before the current race, the current root race that's going on right now that Blavatsky talks about. So,
I find it hilarious. Well, I do find it hilarious, actually, that when you look at the outdated views of Egyptologists and how they could possibly think that these monstrous pyramids were tombs when you walk in them, they're machines. There's so much apparatus involved, but they don't look at it. And an engineer can tell them, look, this can't be a tomb because this. And they still say, no. You know, even in the face of evidence. I mean, Robert Schock, John West pointed out that the Sphinx is extremely old. They don't care. They're beholden to their historic data, which for the most part is outdated, and it just drives me nuts when I read about these people and how we're being told these things that are coming to light as being false, given the new data. So let's update our data.
Exactly, and let's do real science. Let's do science. Let's do LIDAR. Let's do radioactive dating. Let's do all the science stuff. Let's do all the things that we can use to really conduct great research. In fact, that's one thing that Robert Schock is doing right now. I don't know if you want to put this on the radio, but he has an organization. I'm forgetting the name of the organization right now. Gosh, I just blanked it. But he's actually putting together an organization to do research on all these ancient things. And so he's asking for people to donate, you know, if they can, money or time to conduct these studies that will be the bridge between science and spirituality, which will, you know, go and look at the Sphinx. You know, for example, Schock talks about the Sphinx being an incredible deluge of water, that water has been around the Sphinx for multiple millennia, and that it's far older than anybody ever thought, you know, 12, 13, 14,000 years old. I mean, that's what he's stating right now. You know, he and John Anthony West did an incredible amount of research, you know, in the 80s to begin all of those studies. And so, you know, I hope you can't hear my dogs barking in the background. It's almost like, we're going to act up now.
It's okay.
Add my three children, you know. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Hey, let's move on. I want to talk to you about an area that's very prominent in your book from Blavatsky. And I've always, I mean, this is even before I discovered yugas, and that is the root races. And I want you to explain it because some of the numbers given to these races is amazing. So the first root race was 130 to 150 million years ago. The second root race was 25 to 30 million years. Oh, no, excuse me. The second.
Yeah, that's right.
Can't be right. Is that right?
Yep, you're right.
So the third root race is a few million years ago. But talk about the first root race, and because the reason it's fascinating is that it's more of a conscious period and not a physical period. So talk a little bit about that, which I find it fascinating.
Right. It is fascinating. And it's the term that Blavatsky gives is the sons of men. And that's the, she uses actually a couple of other terms, but I'll just use that for the sake of simplicity. And, you know, she dates it to about 130 to 150 million years ago. And, you know, that's when I believe that we were in conscious form. We were conscious as cellular life and as human life. But the bodies that we used were basically like large cell bodies is the way that I understand it to be. One of my teachers in the past called them large ovoid bodies. So here's these huge cellular bodies that were probably, you know, 100 feet in diameter. I mean, that's huge. And that's basically when you're thinking about the life of that ancient human ancestor. I mean, they had consciousness, but they didn't have soul. There wasn't a soul connection. There was just the body. The body was it was almost like an etheric body. It was partially even light. It wasn't like we understand matter to be in these times of a physical body where, you know, arms and legs and a trunk and all of that. And it was a light body, and it was evolving, and it was connected to the cellular life on this planet. Yet there was an intelligence in that life that allowed it to evolve and to, you know, gain knowledge and gain, you know, a spiritual flow, so to speak, so that over time it began to, I mean, it was like cell reproduction. There was cell division. It was just like we understand cell bodies today in biology. you know, cell division, that's how we recreated ourselves. And then moving on, as we got more evolved, we went into what was called the Lanu, or also it's called the Hyperborean race, which was about 25 to 30 million years ago. And at that point, still had these large bodies, but they were becoming more compact. They were developing filament arms, legs. It was still somewhat etheric, but it was becoming more condensed. And in those times, from the Hyperborean into the Lemurian, there was we had two sexes. I mean, we know that in cell biology, that there's as life evolves, it becomes, you know, there can be two sexes to a life. So there was a male and female component, and they were in the same body, so that reproduction occurred in the same body with components of a male and female, those genders, so to speak. I mean, it's very removed, but I mean, that's one way to articulate it. And so it wasn't until the Lemurian times, which is about 18 million years ago, when we actually got consciousness, when we got the soul body was actually connecting with these fleshy bodies that we had, and they were fleshy and they were still very large. Probably I would say multiple 50 feet, 60 feet. Again, over time, it was shrinking shorter and shorter into Atlantis. Into Atlantis, we think about, for example, the Greek gods. We think about Zeus. Zeus is always pictured as this huge, giant man, this god, this king of the gods that took care of this planet. And he's viewed as a large body. He's not a small body. So that's how I kind of think about those. And that those are the root races. So we go through Atlantis, which is the fourth root race, and it's into the current, which is, there's different terms for it, but the one current term that's used is Aryan, A-R-Y-A-N, which is typified in the people of India. The Indian body, that small body with the darker skin, that was considered the first Aryan body, and it came up in India. It came up on in the Mideast. That's what the body that we were evolving from. We're still evolving out of that race. And we were dark-skinned before we were white-skinned. We never just had this white skin about us, the people that are Caucasian. We had dark skin. And dark skin was also going to handle the sun and handle the elements a lot better than a white complexion. So, yes, we were dark skinned for a long, long time.
That's fascinating. I've had Dr. Susan Martinez on the program. Her latest book on Pan, which is another word for Mu, which is another word for Lemuria, actually has some really well-researched documents and photos of artifacts from central Mexico. And it's her belief that the Toltec came from Lemuria, their generations, which is quite unique because the Toltecs were extremely creative. When they would overtake a civilization, they usually improved everything around, including
the
pyramids. We see
amazingly, they did.
Yeah, we see it in Chichen Itza with the rebuilding of a lot of the buildings and the very ornate buildings. We see it in Tula, the beautiful buildings. But I want to ask you where you can point to physical evidence of some of these, either Lemurian. We're going to get to Atlantis in a minute because that's a huge interest of mine. But Lemuria is kind of a second focus to a lot of people. Maybe it's because it was so long ago. But why is Lemuria so important?
Well, Lemuria was the place and the time and the root race where we really captured the physical body. Excuse me, we actually came out of this cellular body with the filament legs and arms and developed into a true hominin. I mean, we actually had the ability to walk around and move, and we had a division of the sexes So there was a lot that happened in Lemuria. And also, Lemuria, the location of Lemuria is around the Pacific Rim. I mean, that's where we think of Lemuria as originating. So when you think back about Lemuria, you think about the islands, you think about the Ring of Fire, you think about, you know, a time in humanity's history where we were still evolving. It was a hot, there was molten lava. And even today, if you look at that part of our world, it's molten. I mean, you know, you look at, for example, I'm trying to think of the name of it. There is a, I'm just blank that, a Nan Madal. There's a, there's an island called Nan Madal where there are post piles where this ancient rock that was hot rock would move into these pillars, and they actually made different parts of the land out of these pillars. But then the mythology of that is that these pillars also could rise into the air and fly. So, I mean, that's the mythology of Nan Madal. So I'm not sure if Dr. Susan is talking more about that. I'm not incredibly familiar with her work, but now I want to go out and look into that research because it
she
sounds interesting.
She actually gets into the specific races that came out of Lemuria, which mm-hmm. I find quite fascinating. It's actually a compliment to your book because she gets into quite a bit of physical anthropology.
What's her last name again? How do you spell the last name on that?
Martinez, Martinez.
Got it.
Easy.
I'll look her up.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the Toltec. I mean, you know, the actually when people were actually traveling from Lemuria, they traveled from Lemuria over to South America, and then slowly also to North America. I mean, there was migrations before Atlantis. There were migrations from Lemuria. So, I mean, we know that people were definitely migrating from Lemuria, definitely.
This is what's very interesting to me, and this is why you're on the show, is there such a huge connection with Lemuria. Now, the elders, the native elders I've had on this show, talk about a path from Lemuria to Mexico up and to southwestern United States, and apparently satellite evidence shows that these very ancient trails are still visible leading from Mexico into the lower United States. For me, one of the big telltale signs of the Maya is that, and this is used to be very hard for me, that Edgar Cayce talks about Lemurians and the last middle phases of Atlantis comprising the people we call Maya today. And this is the very early Maya. It's very hard for me because I want to see more physical evidence. And I think it's going to have to come down to new types of scanning technology to scan the buildings that we have present in the Yucatan Peninsula. And I think that is the closest evidence we have to Atlantis and Lemuria, simply because they found evidence of similar buildings off the shores of the Bimini Islands. So,
and you look at the figures of the people are Asian. I mean, you look at the Olmec, for example, the Olmec figurines. And the Olmec are a combination of races. They're Asian, they're Hispanic, they're African-American type, you know, coloring and features, but they're a mixture. So we know that there was some connection that had to go over that direction towards Asia. Asia was connected to South America and also North America.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we see that in the sculpture, you know, I mean, that's one of the, you know, it's noted in the sculpture of these two areas. I mean, that's, if you look in Central America, and again, you're seeing that bridge of people. The people have similar traits. They have similar rites and rituals. For example, there's some of the root word, the Virach. If you go to South America, Virach is a root word that you see in South America. We also see that in India, and you also see that in Assyria. So how do you connect all these cultures with a root word of virach, V-I-R-A-C-H, and then you add on the end to make it fit that culture, whichever of those that you're looking at. So, I mean, even the linguistics are connected to these cultures.
Which is very strange. Yeah, it's wonderful.
It is very strange.
I love it.
You know, that's those are the kind of idiosyncrasies I would see. I'd say, oh, my gosh, look at this language going on here. We've got this in India, and we've also got it in South America. Like, how does that happen? There is a bridge. There is a connection. And that's the stuff that goes outside science. I mean, it's science. I mean, it's language. It's linguistics. But yet, to bridge the two, that's where the spirituality comes in.
So, exactly.
This is fun. I'm having a good time.
let's talk about Atlantis in the few minutes that we have left. We're getting down to our time here. Talk a little bit about the three phases of Atlantis, how old it is, and then because Casey talks about the three destructions. So talk a little bit about that.
There's actually, excuse me just a minute. There was actually several different parts of Atlantis that ended. Excuse me. And I'm trying to actually get the actual ages, but the last age, the last island ended 11,000 years ago. But then there was the part that ended about a million years before that, and then the part that began about 4 million years ago when Atlantis really, really began to dissolve. So, I mean, you have those three times, and those are just, I'm not giving you exact dates. Those are just estimations. Mm-hmm. But it was a gradual process. It was, humanity was evolving, but it was radically evolving such that people began to do what we call the black arts, and Blavatsky talked a little bit about getting into the dark arts, and that's what actually took people away from the compassion and the goodness and the golden age of Atlantis, is that they were using these gifts that they had from evolution and spirituality for negative means, for materialism, for ways to harm other animals. I mean, there were lots of different problems that occurred in Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a huge break. That's when we call it the Rainbow Bridge. There was this huge crevasse between, you know, man and spirit that began, and it's never actually come back together. I mean, we still tell stories, the stories of the flood. I mean, how many different cultures have a flood story? I mean, we talk about Sumer, we talk about Assyria, we talk about Egypt, we talk about the biblical stories of Genesis and how the flood dissolved so many different things. And it was also a time when all of that was happening that, I mean, we think about Moses. Well, Moses supposedly in the beginning of Atlantis took these languages, took all of this intelligence from Lemurian Atlantis and brought it to Egypt. And that's where we developed a lot of different information. It's actually called mosaic. So you take the word Moses and you add AIC to it. But we think about what a mosaic is. It's actually comprised of lots of different tiles, but it's also comprised of different language and different information. So, I mean, it's this incredible gift that we get from these ancient biblical and ancient traditions. Gosh, I'm kind of rambling there. But
What can you tell us about our understanding of Atlantis? Because most archaeologists and anthropologists, if you mention the word Atlantis, they are immediately resistant to any suggestion of a place like that ever existing, even though it appears that elements and a great influence from a highly advanced culture is evident in different parts of the world. I just gave a good example of the Maya, and I'm a field researcher of the Mayan ruins in the Yucatan area. I've been down there almost a dozen times, and I think there's a big connection to an unknown civilization, probably Atlantis. But what do you say about their influence?
I think that the Atlanteans, the many faces of Atlantis, has absolutely contributed to the different races on the planet. I mean, we think about the Maya, we think about the Inca in, you know, in Peru. Yeah. You mentioned the, talked about the Toltec. The Toltec are also connected to Israel somehow from what Blavatsky, her research, Teotihuacan. I mean, there were the Aztec came out of Atlantis. And then in Asia, the Mongols and different races that came out of China and moved down into Europe, ultimately becoming places in Spain, the Basque, moving over into Russia, the Slavs. I mean, over time, over hundreds of years and thousands of years, these groups, these tribes really were just traveling all over Europe and all over North America. So then in North America, you had the indigenous peoples, and there are hundreds of tribes that were all over North America and also up into Canada and so forth. So, I mean, there were all these bridges that were coming out of Atlantis into North America, South America, and then travel over into Europe and into the Mideast. But some of those were also coming out of that. I talked about the Gobi Desert. It's also the Gobi, it was called the Gobi Sea. That's the way that Blavatsky talks about it. Moving down through Europe, down through Asia, moving down across Asia, and then down into, you know, India, and all the way down to the bottom of the land masses. So, I mean, this is an incredible migration. There were different root races, different groups of people evolving over time. So, I mean, there was just incredible, incredible groups happening everywhere, all over the planet. You know, people were fleeing out of Atlantis. So that's part of what you ask about, why people don't want to think about it. Atlantis was a tragedy. It was a mistake. It was that break from God. People don't want to think about how they were separated from the way that everybody thinks about God in their own way, whoever they are on this planet. Everybody has a view of being connected to this great power, Mother Nature, and then being in, you know, not connected, you know, broken apart. And that's where we lost so much, because we didn't have that spiritual self that was powering us. We weren't connected to the planet. We weren't connected to the skies and the constellations. We were just these human beings that had messed up and became too materialistic, and we were scrapped, so to speak, if you will.
Wow.
And here we were, all over the planet, in all these various little tribes and places and various land masses, left to our own druthers. And there was a lot of problems that happened. You know, people became so broken apart. There were problems with, you know, wars and, you know, things that have happened over the last, you know, say 3,000 years that we can see in science. But beyond that, people were killing each other all over the planet after that. But they don't know why. So there isn't, again, that amnesia, that unconsciousness. We know it happened, but we don't really want to fess up, because then if we do, then we've got to think about it. Uh-oh. Mm. So how do we reconnect with our Godhead? How do we find Mother Nature? How do we find the, you know, Orion, Sirius? How do we find our other star that's out there? How do we reconnect and become whole again?
Wow.
So that's the lesson, is how to not mess up with materialism.
Exactly. Why, and we're coming down to our time here, why would someone want to buy your book? I mean, I think it's a wonderful book, but why? I mean, that might be a hard question for you, because you're just like, I didn't think of that.
But you know, I didn't think of that.
Okay, well, I'm putting
it to you
right now.
I don't know if people think about that.
I typically ask another question. I typically ask, you know, what do you want people to get out of the book? And you can take that one if you want, because that's probably what people are interested in. But, you know, I think the other one, the other question is also important. Why would someone want to buy your book? If they're listening to your
question
right now, obviously they're interested in ancient history. So I think you have a passionate audience listening to the show.
I think that my book is a map to our past. And I think that it creates great roadways and great freeways and different ways to move around, because I've covered all these foundations of humanity. I've covered the sciences. I've covered spirituality, covered the things that people want to know about in mythology. How is it mythology? And I've different stories. How do these stories lend themselves to our past? Well, they do. So that would be another reason why a person would want to buy this book, is they could look into mythology and go, well, how is it there's that story in mythology? I also have a section that is specifically just linguistically, I've got glossaries. I've got places in the back of the book where you can look up certain words and find where they are in the book. So I've cross-referenced mm-hmm. lots of different things for people. So they can even look up, I just blanked the language. Geez, it starts with an S, and it's in India. God, my brain just went, you can look up an ancient language and go, for example, here's the back end of the glossary. And let's say you're going to look up booty in Sanskrit, B-U-D-D-H-I, and there's a whole explanation. I was able to put one of the glossaries from one of the theosophical groups. They allowed me to put that in the back of my book. I had a lot of help from the theosophical groups. Yeah, from the
Wonderful.
Theosophical groups in America and also in the United Kingdom. They lent me lots of different help. A lot of the different drawings too, all the drawings, and there's a lot of art in the book. So if you can look at the artwork and get a sense of what I was trying to communicate, various pictures that I might place in the book. So, and then the science, you can look in the beginning of the book and go, okay, here's the science. We're going to go back to the Big Bang. Book starts out with a Big Bang. So you can start with your basic science and look at science. So, I mean, I think the book is multidimensional. So that's why I think people should buy it. You can find what you need in this book.
I like that answer, multidimensional, because it makes it interesting. Jan, it's been great having you on the program. The title of the book is Anthrogenesis, the Study of Humanity's Ancient Beginnings, Origins, Spirituality, and Mythology. And my guest has been Janet Hazar Hansford, Dr. And it's fun. Now, can people get the book on Amazon? How can people get a copy?
Yes, it's available through Amazon. It's actually going to be available starting, I'm hoping, Monday. It's being shipped as we speak. So the final version, which is the second edition of the book, is going to be available.
Okay.
But it's on Amazon. So all you have to do is put my name on there or the name of the book, and you'll be able to find it.
Okay, and you have a website too. What's the website?
It's JanetHizarHansford.com. So it's JanetHizarHansford.com.
Okay, that's easy enough. Jan, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed our talk, and hey, much success with this book.
Thanks, Cliff. I really appreciate you having me on the show today. It's been a pleasure, and let me know. I'd love to talk with you again sometime. This has been just terrific, and I've enjoyed every moment.
So that was Jan Hansford. I checked the version that I reviewed. It has over 200 pages of references and quotes and things like that. The new version eliminates a lot of that. And according to Jan, those references will be on the website. So the book comes on, I think it comes under 400 pages, maybe less, but it really is a complete encyclopedia of the ancient past. It gets into mysticism, the Blavatsky, all kinds of references from the ancient past, mythology, and what it means. And she really spent an exorbitant amount of time really researching each of these subjects. So if a topic comes up here on Earth Ancients or in your reading, you can easily pull Jan's book, Anthrogenesis, out and refer to that subject matter. So it's a great deal of detail to use. So I really suggest you checking it out. I didn't see it as of right now on Amazon, but by Monday it will be out. If you want to get a copy and you can't see it on the Amazon page, go to her website, Jan Hazar Hansford.com, and you can probably pick up a book copy there. So, okay, that's it for today's show. Hey, remember, get out, get out and enjoy the sun. The summer is quickly coming to an end. If you're in the coastal area of Texas, God bless you. Hope you can make it through. I just read that the storm, the hurricane, is a lot less in strength than they had thought it would be. So hopefully there'll be minimal damage. My brother lives in Louisiana. He just said they don't have anything going on there, which is really close to the Gulf coast of Texas. So hang in there, guys. Hey, and remember the 99-cent special. For just 99 cents, you can get over 8,500 titles from Gaia, and it just keeps growing. Go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. Okay. Next week, our program, Ancient Dreams, how the ancients interpreted dreams, how they developed dream therapy, and why dreams are important for us today. Next week on Earth Ancients. Hey, have a great one.